You're listening to Pirate Cat Radio, KPCR LP 92.9 FM Los Gatos, and KMRT LP 101.9 FM Santa Cruz. Tony Duchesne here, and welcome to Drinks with Tony. We start my novel writing workshop online Friday, September 19th at 4 p.m. Pacific. Go to drinkswithtony.com for the link to register, as spots are still available. If you're subscribing to my Substack, you will find two novels that I've loved over the last 2 months and I'm posting for review. One is by an Irish author published in 2024. The other, an author from Los Angeles, published in 1985. Who are they? What do they have in common? We'll find out by subscribing to Duchesne.substack.com, where I also confess my imposter syndrome at this very moment while I query agents with my completed manuscript of Dreamcasting. A friend of mine sent this to me today regarding writing novels, and it blew my mind. It's from the Twitter page of V.E. Schwab. Look, writing books isn't that hard. All you have to do is build an armored giant out of all of your fears and then fight it to the death and melt the metal down to forge a pair of doors locked by doubt and go on a quest to find the key and then sit your butt down in a chair and write. How powerful is that? And that's why I want you to join my novel writing workshop, because I want more people diving into the world of novel craft and creation. We meet starting this Friday, September 19th at 4 p.m. Go to drinkswithtony.com for the link to register. And now, on with the show.
Hi, I'm Carlo Rotella, and you are listening to Drinks with Tony.
Get on the Drinks with Tony show.
You're listening to Drinks with Tony. I'm your host, Tony Duchesne. Today on the show, we have Carlo Rotella. He's the author of What Can I Get Out of This? Teaching and Learning in a Classroom Full of Skeptics. Carlo, how are you?
I'm well. How are you doing?
I'm all right. It was fun as we were talking before we started the show about that you live in Brookline, Boston. And I feel like the time that I spent in Boston, there's a great, like, I just feel a literary vibe there. Was I imagining it, or do you think that actually is the case?
One of the great surprises of my life is how much I've taken to living in Boston, and how much I regard it as my place now. And I think it is in part because it's old and you can walk, and because it's a book town. I mean, basically it's a company town, and the company is school. And that makes sense to me. Also, no right angles almost anywhere in the city, except for in the Back Bay. And when I'm in a normal city like Chicago, which is where I'm from, I'm like, it's so boring. Everything's 90 degrees, you know, and I'm used to, you know, five-way intersections and things curving and being raggedy, which is how Boston's laid out.
I think that's what also endears me to it too, because I have such a weird thing about aesthetic, which is why I live in Los Angeles right now, and I have a hard time living in Los Angeles because the aesthetic is not good in general. It's just sprawling grid, and but in Boston, it's truly like the European city of the United States. I think it's kind of got that vibe where when I'm in like Paris or Porto, there are those like, it's like everything is like kind of curved and sexy, and Boston has the same thing.
And also, you know, driving optional, which is
rare for an American.
I can go to the supermarket, on foot, you know, I can go to work, I can ride my bike, or, you know, all that. So that has become my new normal. And as I, you know, I work, I basically think I think of myself as working for a company called School Incorporated, you know, a globe spanning company, but I just work in the Chestnut Hill branch office at Boston College. And that feels normal, you know, that Boston's so full of schools, just school is everywhere in Boston.
They have a radio station at Boston College that I was on about before COVID. I was on there to talk about writing. And the kids were like, I mean, the staff, but I look at them as kids, because I used to be a college radio DJ too back in the 90s, you know. So it's just like, and it was just so heartwarming. They were just so like, it's I was touched. I walked out of there, and even though I know that we weren't broadcasting on any big FM or Sirius XM thing, that's like a better experience for me than going through something that's like larger. It's just, it feels true. There's just.
I also think that it's okay if you call them kids. You know, I feel as I get older, I feel like especially Boston College students, they kind of are good kids. And I feel like they turned me into a totally stereotypical Italian American man. I'm like, they're basically good kids, you know, and they are basically good kids. They're, and the admissions policy sort of favors kind of the astronaut model, you know, good grades, socially involved, you know, play sports all around, you know, people who kind of aced adolescence. So they really are good kids. I've learned to value that a lot.
Yeah. How long have you been teaching there?
25 years.
Wow. So have you been in Boston for 25 years?
A little longer. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Okay. For some reason, I thought you were a little more new to Boston, but that's why that's why we have mutual friend Robert in amongst our sphere of writers.
Right. Well, he's from Rhode Island originally, right?
Yeah.
Robert and Nacy.
Yeah.
So I also think of myself as kind of new to Boston. Boston's not one of those places, like you have to be born here or else you're never from here.
Yes.
Unlike
okay.
Chicago and New York. Chicago and New York is perfectly okay to be a hinterlander, and you come to those places and people after a while, they see you as, but I used to write a column for the Boston Globe, and I felt like at the beginning of every column there was an invisible bracketed phrase that was like, I'm not from here, but you know. So just trying to head off, you know, all the comments would be like, this guy's not from here.
Wow. That's I love the Boston Globe, because the Boston Globe did a half page review of my novel in 2010. In the entertainment section, and Boston game. Mm-hmm. Well, the review wasn't great. The review was like, do we really need this? The summing up of the review was, I was just like, ew, did I hurt your feelings or something? But at the same time, what am I supposed to do? Because the reader and the reviewer get their journeys to stay out of the way. And I actually got a lot of people from Boston and people saying, oh, I found you about your book in the Boston Globe. And it's just all this, I realized all you can do, no matter what coverage you get in any magazine or newspaper, even if you think it's wrong coverage, is just say thank you.
Mm-hmm. I think that's reasonable. I think most, you know, most things, most, even most good work kind of sinks without a ripple. So if somebody notices, that's good.
Yeah. Yeah. I used to write, I did literary coverage and music coverage for the San Francisco Chronicle for about 9 years. And what I should have had before as a, what do you call it? What you just called it.
The bracketed phrase, right?
Yeah. The bracketed phrase I always had in mind was, he's not a writer. We're going to fire him after this one. We just don't have the guts to tell him yet. And every single article I turned in, which was probably, let's say in the, you know, 200 to 300 articles over the span, every single time I knew the San Francisco Chronicle was going to realize that they got the wrong guy. And then when they asked me, okay, what are you writing next week? And I went, oh, I'm still in. And it just, that never went away. I don't know if that's just me with low self-esteem, or is that something you feel happens with writers, or a little of both?
I don't know. I mean, I wrote a column, and I felt the just the need to have regular ideas was hard on me after a while. I did it for 5 years, and it was difficult. And I will say one thing that was really good about it was, because of that fear you're describing, I went out and did a lot of stuff. You know, it caused me to go to openings of things and to go see, you know, new plays and all that, just because I knew I was going to need to be having ideas, right? So it made me a much better citizen of sort of the artistic and cultural world I was moving in, just because I didn't want to wake up, you know, the column was due Wednesday at noon. I didn't want to wake up on Wednesday, you know, ready to gaze at my navel and produce a column, you know, so I wanted to have done something over the weekend that was column worthy in some way, you know, to go see something or go meet somebody or interview someone or go to a premiere or something, you know?
Yeah. I feel like, okay, so I have this thing where I get reluctant about going to things, even though it's just like, oh, that sounds like a great idea. And then I'm just like, I really don't want to go. And then, but if I had something like I had a deadline that I had to cover it, then it makes me go. And I don't know. Maybe I don't know if that's if I had a COVID switch in my brain when we were all in like and then all of a sudden I was like, oh, I like antisocial or what. But there's something about having a little more of a little more like, oh, you have a deadline, so you have to go to this. And then every time, well, 85% of the time I go, I have a great time and walk away with a great experience. Just because I've interacted with people. Who knew?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of people report that about the pandemic is that it just reset their default, further over towards not going out, further over towards just I'll just be cozy, I'll be in my sweats, and whatever my PJs, and I'll leave the house, and it'll be cozy, I think a lot of people report that they kind of established a new floor or a new ceiling, depending on how you look at it, as how much going out do they crave and how much do they want, right?
And then, and
And
my
for
other
people like
thing,
me,
yeah, people like you.
oh, sorry, just people like me, teaching is like, well, if I had to do it online all the time, I would stop doing it. Like for me, it just drove home how important the face-to-face part of teaching is, and I really didn't like doing it online. A screen full of tiny little rectangles for people was just very difficult for him.
It's the thing about, because I teach screen reading classes at UCLA Extension, and before COVID I was like, I need to be in that classroom, and they're like, we could put you online. I'm like, no, I need to be there. I need to, we I they need to see the fear. I need to see the fear on their faces and console them when I give them, assignments. And then now they're like, hey, so we can have you back now. But the commute of an hour each way, I was just like, you know what? No, I can't. And then I was like, I'll do the downtown campus. And they're like, oh yeah, but we're not doing screenwriting. We're not scheduling there. And I'm just like, okay. So then I'm kind of, I, but during COVID, I feel like I learned how to teach online, even though it's not the, I'm telling you, you're so right about the person-to-person thing. It's makes all the difference. But I feel like I got a little bit of a groove down that I would never have had before. Like I learned a new muscle, and out of necessity. And then I feel like, you know what? It works. It's nice
I
to
think,
be.
yeah, I mean, it's a different skill set, and I didn't really develop it. And it also just made me aware how much I am aware of kind of bodies in the room, like how much I will use the bodies in the room to decide, like, oh, we better stick on this for a while. We didn't figure this out. People are still iffy on this one, or okay, we're done with this, we're ready to move to the next thing, or do you want to respond to what she just said? That's so easy in person, but that's so hard, but yes, we came up with a set of signals online for like, well, if you already had your hand up and you want to respond to what the person just said, we're going to have another color hand you could put up. You can do stuff online to mimic that. But I just, I find the face-to-face thing so ever more rare and precious. And it's not just the face-to-face part, it's in a room with 20 or 30 people who've all read the same thing, no devices, that I just crave it, I feel like it's a more and more cutting edge technology in a way that every ed tech advance makes being in a room with people who've all read the same thing this rarer and more valuable thing.
And you can also feel energy on body language that we just don't get on online too. Like you could just see somebody even adjust their like legs or something, and then maybe just there's so much more access to seeing everyone at once than on a screen, where I like even as we talk, if we were in person, we'd probably be speaking a little differently. We would probably be picking up on different social cues, and we just have this square that we're on. And so we have to bear with the communication we can do about this square, and also looking into each other's eyes while we're not actually looking into each other's eyes.
So and we have to be a little ginger about how we hand it back and forth, on Zoom, whereas in person you can step on each other's lines, or you can, you know, signal with your body that you're going to come in now, or you can take a, you know, a breath. You know, there's all kinds of things you can do, and all that stuff. It seems trivial, but I think it's not actually. It's all like very powerful stuff. You know, one of the things I do with classes is I tell them, like, there's two kinds of classes. There's a class where when we come in before class, everybody's looking at their phones. And there are classes where when we come in before class, everybody's talking to each other. So let's be the second kind, you know, let's intentionally do that. And that's awkward, which is, you know, every 18-year-old's nightmare word, for like 30 seconds the first time. And then it's fine, you know. But that it's so much better to start a class by quieting the hubbub of people talking to their neighbors than it is by saying, okay, let's get started. Everybody has to like rip their eyes away from their phone and, you know. And get down to it. Whereas they're already talking, they're already engaged with each other, you know?
Yeah. You've seen students over the last 25 years. How do you feel students have changed? Because you've watched technology kind of take all of our brains and turn them into mush. Right. I mean, none of us are unaffected by this thing. I was doom scrolling this morning, and then I'm sitting there going, why am I not reading a book instead of doing this?
Yeah.
And I put it away, but I have to consciously do that. And it's and so you've been able to see the progression, I guess, in a way. Like, how do you feel we're going, and how do you feel where we're at and where we were? And that is like the most long question you please don't be too profound, because I threw way too much at you.
Well, it's fine. I mean, I don't have a truly deep answer. I mean, I think school is always both things at once. School is sort of, school's always school, and it's kind of always the same. And I think, although some things are very different, like it's much harder to get in than it used to be. Once you get in the room and you've all read the book and you're talking about it, it's kind of the same as it used to be. On the other hand, everything changes, right? So in terms of the quality of the conversation we have, I would say it's probably about the same as it was when I was an undergraduate in the 1980s, right?
Yeah.
But many things are different about it. You know, obviously students are much more anxious than they used to be. They're also much more professional. They're much more professional students than they used to be. You know, it's just much harder to get into college. You know, you have to ace adolescence to get into college. It's like when a bunch of freshmen walk in. So the book is about a required freshman literature class. And when a bunch of 18-year-olds walk into the classroom on the first day, my first reaction is always, this is a club the 18-year-old me would not have been invited to join, right? I wouldn't have. I just didn't have the grades or the extracurriculars to compete. And it just wasn't necessary in 1982 to have that stuff. So they're more anxious, they're more professional, they've probably read fewer books, but they're pretty damn good at school. They've been in school with this objective in mind of getting into a selective college for a long time. So I think that's different. I think people are, in general, and anything that I say about students applies to everybody else too. It's not just students, it's college.
Yeah.
But I think people are more put off by unfamiliar prose than they used to be. So if you teach a 19th century novel, just 19th century diction is harder for people. I liken it to sort of running on the beach. You know, sand makes people tired. Some people love running on sand, but most people find running on sand really hard. And reading, I taught Edith Wharton in this course that the book is about, and a lot of students found that just incredibly difficult. I think more difficult than students would have found it in the past. It's just unfamiliar prose. So, but in terms of, like, you know, big things, right? Like, you get these big pronouncements from people, you know, students don't read anymore and all that. I find none of that to be true. I think they're pretty good writers. They're good thinkers. They work hard. They're very game. I sort of take the gameness of students as a given, and assume it. And then the question is, well, what am I going to ask them to do? What am I going to try and teach them? Or what am I going to help them practice doing? So I'm very suspicious of people my age saying, like, well, in my time, you know, we had deep philosophical conversations. Like, well, actually, you just probably did more bong hits. You know, I don't know that that's true.
Yes. Have you ever recorded yourself stoned? No. Wait.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's like I don't get stoned anymore, and I'm not really good at getting stoned. But when I have gotten stoned and wrote the most brilliant, thing I ever thought of in my life, the next day I am just like, "What is this? It means
Well,
nothing.
that's like all
Nothing
those
great has."
book ideas on bar napkins, you know, like great idea for book, you know, guys trying to kill a whale. Like, oh no, actually, yeah. So I'm not big on decline narratives, and there's this tradition in American culture of letters of writing these Jeremiads about what's wrong with college and college students these days. Books
Yes.
like The Closing of the American Mind or Excellent Sheep. And the thing about those books is there's no students in them. You know, so one of the things I really wanted to do is have going, you know, what happens in class happens inside the heads of students. So,
Yeah.
you know, I spent a couple of years asking students what was going on in their minds in this class that we had together. And you would think that would be the most obvious and typical thing to do, but it's actually pretty rare. There aren't that many books out there about college that actually have students in them as characters. You know, there's one right now that I really like called Hacking College by Scott Carlson and Ned Laff. That's about sort of how to do college on the macro level. And that has a lot of student voices, you know, but that there's not that many more. You know what I mean? Usually it's just a professor saying, kids these days, finish the sentence, you know.
And it's do you feel like some of these professors are just so disconnected from their students? There are these people who I find this at where I teach screenwriting, and a lot of these screenwriting instructors that teach early quarters, and then I get their students later when they're supposed to be further along, and I'm like, who did you take? And it's just like they didn't challenge. You know, I'm just like, I call it, they just pinch their cheek the whole time and said, oh, your writing is great. And I'm like, did they teach you this part? Did they tell you about it? No. And then when these students come to me, they either love what I do, or they're like, no, I need my cheek pinched. I'm going to someone else.
Right here.
Yeah. Give me a little kiss.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, I have a lot of respect for my fellow teachers, and especially the earlier grades. Like sometimes I feel like third grade is the main event, and I'm just cleaning up. You know, by the time we get to college, I'm cleaning up whatever happened in third grade and high school. You know, middle. When I think about teaching English in middle school, I think that's a hard job. You know, my job.
Yeah.
Than that.
Yeah.
So I think of it much more, instead of like, well, did they have good teachers or bad teachers? I just think of it much more as like, well, we got 15 weeks, which means we have 2,000 minutes together, basically, right? So what can I ask them to do in those 2,000 minutes where they're gonna get better at some kind of craft skill, whatever that is? And I'm you know, opposed to brilliance in the classroom. And I just like, we're gonna lay pipe that doesn't leak. That's kind of our,
yes,
you know, like we're going to make arguments and then we're going to see where they're weak and make them stronger, or you know, we're going to see if maybe we make a better argument, we're going to get stuck and back up and go around, and that's what we're going to do. We're going to practice the craft of extracting meaning from the world, but we're going to practice on novels and poems and movies and things like that. So I guess I'm allergic to abstraction, you know. I'm pretty practical, and as a result of that, I feel like almost any teacher, there's some kind of portable principle, there's some kind of toolkit move that they've got to offer. Even a teacher that you or I might think, oh, well, they're kind of mostly wasting the student's time. There's gonna be a student in your class for whom that teacher is important, because that teacher had a particular portable principle that they had to offer, and it was the right time for that student, and it's valuable. So I'm always struck by teachers who I think they have nothing to offer, and then I have a very good student who thinks that teacher had a lot to offer them. Right.
Oh, that's fascinating. See, I feel like you do a lot of great communication with your students, and that probably, I mean, they probably really respect you in a new way, because you're actually coming to, you're coming to like level to level. We're going to talk human to human about this. I'm putting a lot on you, but I feel like the less than an hour that I've known you, this is what I have assessed.
But that's your call, right? Well, I would say that one of the things I try to persuade students of is don't use your English voice, when you write or when you like, don't, you know, throughout all time, man has struggled to under, like that voice, just let's just, make an assertion and try to prove it. And let's start from, your response to the work. So I'm not big on like literary criticism. I'm big on extracting meaning out of things, right? And those things, as I said, we practice on literature, but that's the same set of skills you need for like understanding the State of the Union address or like the state of your neighborhood, anywhere where you need to sort of recognize patterns, see repetition, see, particular word choices and images and things like that, and start looking for an organizing logic, right? And I just think of that as a craft. It is not, it's definitely not a science, right? But it's also not an art. It's a craft. Like it's like building a cabinet, or planting a garden. And I feel like I can, in 15 weeks, in 2,000 minutes, we can practice that and get somewhere. And that's a skill that you'll have at your disposal as a thinking person, as a citizen, as a worker, whatever you're going to do in life.
I feel like people who I feel like, well, I have a lot to I have so much to say on what's great about novels and how important it is for everyone to read novels, like as a constant practice in their life, because it just, for me, it changes me. It changes me every single time I read a great novel. Oh, it's not here right now. I'm reading Steve Erickson right now. Can't remember the title. I've never read him in my life, and the book is like kind of has dreamy memory shifts, and it's usually a book that I would put down, and I kind of felt like putting it down on page 20, and then I still felt like putting it down on page 50, but there was something that was still asking me to keep going. And then after I got to about a page 100, I'm glad there was that something, that little whatever it was that kept pulling me into the book, that wasn't an easy narrative, turned out to be a beautiful blessing. And it was all it's almost like the it's like a relationship every single time when I read a novel. It's just, and this one was kind of like it wasn't it was I it, let me describe it in a very pedantic and male puberty type of way. It was I thought it was like this hot girl, and then all of a sudden she had depth. Or maybe it's the other way around. I don't know.
Well, I think the novel is sort of the, it is, there's nothing quite like a novel for exactly the experience you're talking about, which is to sort of, what kind of reader does this thing want me to be? How can I get into it? Is it love at first sight? Is it not? And so there's a chapter in the book called It's Okay to Hate the Book, which is about not being paralyzed by being put off by a book, that if even if your first reaction is, oh, I hate 19th century prose. So in this class, it was Edith Wharton's The House of Mirth, which is a novel I love. I love Edith Wharton. And but that was the book that gave the students the most trouble and that the majority of them reported they disliked, right? And I'm fine with that as long as that's the starting point of your relationship to the novel. And that your next question should be, what kind of a reader does this book want me to be? And if I'm irritated by the novel or annoyed by it or put off by it or whatever, the next question should be, how is the novel a machine for producing that reaction in me? And let's take apart the machine. How does it work? Is it the word choice? Is it the situation? Is it the plot? Is it the character system? And one of my favorite, there's a guy in the book named Eli who comes to me when I was interviewing them, and he said, look, I didn't like that book. Let the record show, I did not like The House of Mirth, but I did learn how that you can look at all the characters in the novel as a system and sort of trying to understand the logic that organizes that system. I did learn that from that novel because I hated the characters so much. So to me, that's like victory, right? That he was not paralyzed. Because, people these days especially get so much training in being outraged and then paralyzed by their outrage, or validated and then sort of let off the hook from having another thought by the validation. So I like the kind of you know, grain of sand into a pearl theory of interpretation. You know, like something irritates you about the book and it gets into your shell and it irritates you, so you lay down all those layers of nacreous substance, and then eventually you get a pearl, right?
Yeah.
And that pearl is a novel, right? So and I think novels are great for that, because there's time for the relationship between you and the book to develop, and for you to go through phases. And you know, there's a honeymoon phase, or there's a, you know, initially repelled, like a rom-com, you know, initially you're repelled, but actually you and the novel love each other, you know, like there's all that kind of stuff happens in reading a novel.
And in writing a novel, it's kind of the same way, where you got the honeymoon phase and you love the idea and your characters and you're just having this great juice, and then like 3 months in, you're like, I hate every single one of these people. This idea is stupid. And then that's when the true novelists come out, because that's when you have to go, okay, and we're in. So even though I'm even though my brain is at a standstill on this, and I've lost that that honeymoon effect, I still have to show up every day and put in my time to work through that. Because now I know when I work through it, something better happens, and it's not comfortable in any way at all. And that's the beauty of it. It's, why should it be comfortable, and why should it be easy? It shouldn't. It should be hard.
Well, one of the things writing a novel shares with the process of, you know, reading a novel interpretively, is that the labor is the whole point, you know,
like, yeah. Yes.
You know, so I don't teach like a content, you know, I don't teach like, well, this is realism and this is modernism. Like, students may pick up some of that along the way, but it's just a way of coming at things. You know, it's just a way of like, well, you know, like let's notice things, let's notice aspects of form, let's connect them to theme, and let's try to put these things together. And so that's all just, you know, as you're saying about writing a novel, it's all just practice, staying with it, you know. So that's, you know, in the age of AI, sometimes I think that getting AI to write your papers is actually not quite as bad as getting AI to do the reading for you, which I think is worse, because a bullet point summary of a novel is, you've cleanly missed everything in the novel that could serve as evidence for an interpretation of the novel. You know, all the experience of reading it, the way the sentences flow, the rhythm, all that stuff is, you don't get, you know.
I've noticed when some students have turned in AI work, because they'll get a certain thing, like who's the protagonist, and they'll get it completely wrong, and like five people will be get it like so wrong, and then I'll look up AI and go, who's the protagonist, and it's the same, the AI got it wrong. And I'm just going, okay, you guys. And it's just, it's doing a disservice to ourselves when we don't do the work. It's like taking Ozempic and thinking that that's going to, you know, well, maybe actually work, huh?
I like collecting AI analogies. One of the ones I like is, it's like joining the track team and then doing your laps on an electric scooter. It's like, well, yes, you did go around the track, you know, like, you're not any stronger or faster. But it's a labor-saving device, and it's very hard to say to human beings, yes, there's a labor-saving device, but saving yourself the labor won't do you any good. In this situation, especially in a class like this, which is just practicing a way of coming at things. You know, it would be different if I had a big giant bale of content to deliver to the students, and then they could use AI to create study guides and all, but I'm not doing that. We're practicing together, extracting meaning from these things, and so it's just a labor-saving device. And as I, you know, I try to explain to them, it's like, well, we have had machines for hundreds of years that can move faster than humans and move more weight than humans. But if you want to get stronger and faster, you need to move the weight and you need to run the miles, right?
Yeah.
So, but they're taking five classes, you know, which is a lot of classes. And sometimes it's 2 in the morning, and you know, they're like, look, I got to cut my losses. And so one of the things I say then is like, right then, when you're tempted to just dump the paper assignment into ChatGPT, just write me a one-line email saying I'm going to need an extension, you know?
Yeah.
And then we'll just work it, you know, just that, when that impulse strikes, just get an extension and then come see me, you know, instead of giving in.
I love how you've worked it very well, where you already know, and you're like, look, this is what's going to happen to you, But just get in touch because we can have a bit of a negotiation of sorts of because I would rather you do the work and then just turn in something on time kind of thing.
Yeah, look, I'm in 53rd grade. Like I already got my degree, right? So it's just all I'm doing kind of in class is like playing rhythm guitar, right? So that they can play lead, right? So it doesn't do any good for me to just, for me to say like, that's it, no extensions, I want them to do the work, and if they're going to do the work and it takes them a little longer, I don't care that much, Well, I mean, we are limited by the 15 weeks, but within that, there's a lot of flexibility. And I like all that part of it. I like working with people. I like working with so one of my requirements in my classes is that everybody speaks up in every class meeting, which is hard for people, many people. So I like, if somebody's having trouble, like come into my office and we'll rehearse, we'll practice, and I'll like, here's a question, you raise your hand, like in my office, like I'll ask a
Oh,
question,
that
you
is
raise your
so
hand, answer.
cool.
Let's do it 5 times, which is exactly what a coach would do, or what you would do if you were in a band and you were working on a tricky part. Like, let's just do it a lot. And so there's things like that, and it's just incredibly satisfying when at the next class. So at the end of this meeting, I'll just say like, okay, here's the first question I'm going to ask on Thursday, and I'm going to go to you first, right? It's just incredibly satisfying when that person puts up their hand and you call on them, and the world doesn't end. They say their piece, and then it feels so good that 20 minutes later they put their hand up again, and you just feel like running across to give them a high five,
It's rewiring the brain, and
Yeah.
you're doing things that happen in therapy where we have to get I mean it's a crippling fear. Like people say public speaking is like a crippling fear. I wish I had that crippling fear instead of all the other fears that I
Apparently
have.
not.
But it's like but it's to see someone actually come away from your meeting with them and get over that first hand raise and it's just and what that did to their mind is created the oh this is not flight or fright this is actually an interaction. I feel like it's probably life that might be more life-changing to them than maybe some of the books they're reading.
I think that meta skill stuff in a class like that, which is all discussion, the meta skill stuff, like what you're just describing, being a citizen, anteing up, and having that be important enough that it overcomes your fear. And to your point, it has to stop being public speaking, right? That's the problem, is that it's public speaking. But once you've done it, then it's like, well, I'm just pulling my weight, so that I'm not asking other people to do my work for me, right? But yes, the meta skills like that, I think, are really important, like the ability to join a community that's trying to do something together. Another meta skill that I'm really interested in is like, to what extent, as a student, are you like getting with the program? That is, this is what the professor wants of me. This is what the field, what the discipline, what the class wants of me. To what extent are you getting with the program? And to what extent are you just cherry picking bits and pieces that you want for your own thing, whatever your own thing is, right? So striking that balance between getting with the program and producing, creating your own Jeet Kune Do, like you're inventing your own martial art by stealing moves from other people's martial arts, right? Like, that's a thing that I think you can really practice in college, right? Is you have your own intellectual project of one kind or another, and maybe it's just formative or fuzzy still. And so you're borrowing bits and pieces from different classes to feed that. But then also in each individual class, you're asking, okay, what can I get out of this? If I get with the program, what tools will I put in my toolbox? What will I know that I didn't know before? And all that, it's apparent to me now. It wasn't apparent to me when I was a college student. I was just kind of fumbling along, right? I feel like that's the other thing about school, is that, if you're going to ask me what happened in this class that I wrote the book about, which was in spring of 2020, I said, I won't be around to tell you, but the students who took the class can tell you in 30 years what happened in that class, right? Because then they might finally know, because it takes a while. School is open-ended, it's messy, it doesn't end at the end of the semester.
I feel like the yes, I feel like the best learning environment is just creating someone who's going to continue to learn for the rest of their lives. So there isn't a stamp at, okay, now you have your degree and now go skate. It's no, now you know how to learn. So keep doing this on deeper and deeper levels.
I feel like that's kind of, that's the way I think about it, is that it's, you know, you're sort of, you're offering antidotes to paralysis is what you're doing, mm-hmm. right? So that when you're not there to say, this is what we're going to do. So one of the things that I always say to classes is, okay, here's how you should prepare for class. You should prepare for class so that we start class and then I have a fatal heart attack and drop dead 1 second into class. And you jump up and say, nobody leave. I think I can figure, like, I have a way for us to talk about this, right? That's how you should be ready for class, right? So that that I'm irrelevant. But what you're really preparing for is what you just said, which is when there isn't a teacher around to say, let's talk about it this way, or let's think about it this way. Or, you know, if we're gonna analyze it, why don't we start with this? And over the course of a semester, I will usually move from me saying, okay, let's deal with this novel, like so, to by the end of the semester saying, okay, we got a novel in front of us. Let's first have a discussion about what we're going to do. And then let's do it, right? So that they are taking over the business of deciding how we're going to deal with it.
That is cool. Now you're scaring me about the heart attack thing, because if you do have a heart attack, they'll be like, oh, we've prepared for this. We don't do anything.
Exactly.
And it's just like, so I would also add a little addendum to that. And I would buy a defibrillator and put it on the, just because I
after
have
you've
weird,
saved me, after you've saved me,
after you do that, and call the EMTs. Yeah. And, you know, and I might have bad breath when you do a mouth to mouth, because I'm an older dude when there's just a lot of junk in there, but you'll have that too later in your life.
I do like self-sufficiency. And I like not being the boss, but it takes a while. You have to say, okay, at the beginning, I'm going to be the boss. And then by the end, I want to not be the boss. And that's sort of the natural arc of a semester, if things go well. That's kind of one of the natural arcs of a semester, right?
And I feel like that's you being okay. Now, this is me knowing you for an hour and 3 minutes. This is like you being okay to be vulnerable with your students, and to also like you to know when to stay out of the way, I guess is the...
I think that's a big one. You know, everybody who teaches has a bad habit of responding to everything every student says. Everybody does. I do it. Everybody does it. But so you have to close your mouth. So if somebody says something good, don't just jump in and say it's good. Let somebody else respond. You know, get them talking to each other and all that kind of stuff. And that's the other thing I really like about teaching. There's a lot of chopsmanship that goes into teaching. There's a lot of just how to ask a question. You know, one of the things I've learned is that the word "but" tends to stifle students' responses, but "and" tends to get them going. So if you say, well, we've had a good discussion of chapter 3, and we're starting to see some, you know, themes developing in the sense, but chapter 4 seems to challenge all that, they're like, oh, well, you're saying we were wrong. But if you're like, and chapter 4 now offers us all these other problems that we're going to need to deal with, that sort of you have succeeded in not stifling them with just a word choice, you know, just the briefest little word choice. So all that chops stuff about teaching, I really like, you know, that the way you can gather up the threads. You're like, well, if what she's saying is true, and what he said, and what she said, and also what he said, if we pull that all together, we're starting to get a sense of this. If, and then you ask an if-then question, if all that is true, then what are we going to do about this next chapter, you know? And you're sort of quietly summing up, playing a little rhythm guitar, giving somebody a chance to jump in and take a solo, right?
Yeah. Have you ever seen the film The Wonder Boys? Do you remember that?
I have not.
With Michael Douglas and Rip Torn?
Yeah,
and, okay, you haven't seen it?
Isn't that Michael Chabon's?
Yes, it's based on this book, dude.
Yeah.
Which I don't have I've tried him a few times, and I have a hard time getting into his books, and I've never finished one. That probably says a lot about me, but wait, did he write The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay?
Yes. Cavalier.
Okay, so a friend made me read that to the end. He's like, no, man, you just don't get it, man. You got to read it to the end, man. And I read it to the end, and I'm like, eh.
So I think you just, everybody has the right to respond any way they want, you know? I mean, I have a lot of respect for his his craft skills. I don't always get into his characters or the situations, but and I have a lot of respect for him as a writer, and I share something with him, which is he wrote this at some point about what he read when he was a kid. He said he was raised on a healthy diet of crap. You know, like I read so much like Conan pulp fiction and H.P. Lovecraft, and I was really raised on genre fiction, not on fine literature. And I love the fact that he talks about that. It shows up in his writing in various ways. You know, he wrote a fabulous introduction to the best Viking novel of all time, The Long Ships, that got reissued. And, you know, so I like that. No. He has that deep, that deep faith in the ability to extract an education out of whatever's in front of you, you know. Whether it's highbrow or low.
I've been reading a lot more pulp and crime the last few years. And it's been a lot of fun. Who am I reading right now? Richard Stark. He's got the Parker series The Quarry, Max Collins. And I never found those as a kid, and I'm reading them now. And like the, you know, 56-year-old kid in me is going, this is fun.
Well, formula is great. I mean, I read a lot of fantasy. I read a lot of fantasy when I was a kid. I still do, you know, more fantasy than science fiction. And I teach that stuff too. And oddly, we're in this moment where kids who read, you know, kids who get to college and are readers are often readers of fantasy. You know, they start with Aaron Hunter's Warrior Cat books in third grade, and then they, you know, Harry Potter and Richard Riordan, you know, the sort of standard sequence, but the amount of YA literature that is fantasy or dystopian fantasy of one kind or another is enormous, you know. So that's actually a way in for students to get into literature, you know.
Yeah.
Is that a lot of them are getting raised on this stuff, and that's kind of the last stuff they read on their own, you know. So the typical profile when I interviewed all these students who took this class with me, there were 33 of them, was they read a lot until they got to the end of middle school, and then they switched over to reading what they were assigned, and they switched over more to gaming and other things. But the last things that they deeply get into around the age of 12 and 13 are often fantasy.
And
you never get into a book again like the way you do when you're 13. You know, that's like the deepest you'll ever get into a book, you know.
Yeah.
Like you can, like, you get imprinted by what you read when you're 13.
Wow. I didn't really start reading anything until I was in my mid 20s. I grew up in a weird environment, a weird religion. And so what I read at 13 was just all Bible stuff. And that's
it. But did it leave a deep impression?
It sure did. And I'm still in therapy for it. No, but I do have to say that it did. I do feel like it is part of what created the continued voice that I'm trying to find. Is I, you know, let me talk about Yahweh baking a cake for Hezekiah. You know, it's just like, why do I have that in my brain? I don't know. Well, I do know, but it would have been nice to have, you know, some pulp fiction in there instead. I think it was a little too much for a young kid.
Yeah, well, it was a narrow but deep source, right? Well, you know what? I was a kid in the 70s, and in the 70s, what you could read was pulp fiction from the 30s in paperbacks. So Conan and H.P. Lovecraft, C.L. Moore and Clark Ashton Smith and all that stuff you could buy in paperbacks. And I didn't really realize this stuff had all been written in the 30s, but that's what was like right under your fingers, you know, was that stuff.
Yeah.
And then if you add Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett and you know, like all that stuff is pulp fiction, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
It actually appeared in the pulps, right?
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to read one of my takeaways and one of my assignments from our conversation together is reading House of Mirth.
I love the House of Mirth. And it's funny, students do eventually get into it, you know, because, the situation of the protagonist, Lily Bart, she has to marry because she's in sort of in society, but she doesn't have a lot of money, turn of the century New York. So she has to marry, and she's expected to marry, but the guys are all clowns and fools, right? So she's sort of,
we all are.
She has to marry. Yeah, she has to marry, but there are no good options, right?
Yeah.
And at first the students are like, first world problems, you know. But after a while, they start to see that her situation is sort of an exaggeration of theirs. Do you do what you're supposed to do, or do you, you know, depart from the path? They're 18 years old. They're trying to figure out who they're going to be and what they're going to do. And, you know, in a way, the idea of this 29-year-old society virgin deciding who to marry is totally dystopian and strange to them. But on the other hand, they can see the problem exactly. Like, well, there's a path that she's supposed to do, and the path is distasteful to her, but leaving the path there aren't really any good options, right?
Yeah.
So it takes a while, but they get into it in time.
Yeah, and they can relate it to themselves and relate it to, that's the thing, it's everything's a mirror, I think, of us and our, like, even reading classics. And I just read like Victor Hugo for the first time, Les Miserables, and I was like, you know, I didn't think I was like, oh, you know, maybe I'll get through 50 pages. Oh no, I had to finish the whole thing. I was so sucked in to this character and the morality and that this character had to face. And then also people are like, oh yeah, just skip the Bonaparte parts and the war parts. And I'm like, no, those are some of the best parts.
Don't
like that,
skip
like,
those parts. Yeah.
Yeah. I was just like, what, you want me to read abridged? No way. I got to go the whole
no part
thing.
Skipping. Yeah.
Yeah. And I even forgot why I brought that up. I think because I feel like it was kind of a mirror to me in some ways, and then almost a mirror to our times as well. And I feel like that's what classic literature does in its greatest capacity.
And that's also part of the skill set that you're teaching the students, right? Is that, well, this is one quiver. This is one arrow in your quiver, right? Is that how is this situation familiar to you? It's not the only way to do it, but it is one way to do it. In this freshman class, the theme of the class is the theme of the misfit, right? Which is pretty much guaranteed for a bunch of 18-year-olds to work, right? So we read like Hunter Thompson, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, and Juno Diaz, Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde, and The House of Mirth, and those are all things that are on the one hand very alien to them, and on the other hand they can see the different versions of the problem of, like, well, if you're a misfit, how are you misfitted to the society around you, and what's at stake, you know? And again, there's almost always some sort of portable set of skills that you can derive from that.
Yeah. And also how history repeats itself, and how where this, like, I'm on volume 5 of Proust, In Search of Lost Time. and let me tell you, like, the first three, I was just like, yeah. Sodom and Gomorrah, not as much fun. I'm like, okay, I'm tired of these salons and parties. Volume 5, I'm like, I got another 100 pages, and I'll finish that, and then I'll just give Proust a break for a while. But as I read this, which is, you know, from the early 20th century, they're having the same type of conversations that we have now over petty things, over the gossip. Even and this is where, I don't know if you've heard of the Dreyfus affair. Like, I'd never even heard of that in my life. It's about the guy that was set up as a traitor, and even though he wasn't, but he's Jewish, so it doesn't matter. And it's just like, this is how they talked. And when I was in Paris earlier this year, like, I went and saw Baudelaire's grave, and I went to all these, like, graves. But man, the grave that I went to, where my heart was like, dude, hello, was Dreyfus. I just sat above Dreyfus's grave, and if I didn't read Proust, I would not have had that, like, emotional connection to just being at a gravestone.
I come to him through Zola, who also wrote about the Dreyfus affair. You know, I think that's one of the odd things about, you know, the sort of spotty and weird education you get by reading fiction, right? You pick up these historical things, sort of go across your radar screen, and you start wondering, well, who was this Dreyfus, you know? And when you see it twice, and you start thinking about it. In my case, I was a little, when I was a kid, when I was a teenager, I read James T. Farrell's Studs Lonergan novels. They're novels from the 30s about a guy in Chicago, and it turns out that he He lives in the novels in my neighborhood that I grew up in, South Shore on the south side of Chicago.
Yeah.
And so it's from the 30s, and yet, you know, I'm reading it in the 70s, and it's like, oh, look, there's guys hanging around on 71st Street messing with people in these novels, just like there are, you know, now, right? But on the other hand, everyone in these novels is white, and they live in South Shore to get away from black people. And when I grew up in South Shore, it was 98% black, right? Uh-huh. So the 15-year-old me was saying, okay, I need to know more about the history of my neighborhood.
Right? Yeah.
Because,
yeah.
You know, that part just absolutely does not compute, even though so much of what happens in this novel is familiar, right? So yeah. That was really my introduction to the great transformation of my neighborhood, which happened shortly before I moved into it, right?
Wow.
You know, you find these things in fiction, and yeah. Then they send you on tangents into other fiction, but they also send you out into the world of history and you know, nonfiction of one kind and another.
And that's where the great relationships happen from between the reader and the writer.
Well, you do feel a certain gratitude to the writers you read, especially at an impressionable age, for opening up the world to you, right?
Yeah.
For showing you, you know, ways of knowing the world. There's this argument about the humanities that you know, there's two things that happen in humanities class. You're teaching set of skills, and you're looking at problems in how to live, right?
Yeah.
And I kind of like that model, right? That sort of problems in how to live, because that's where you're, like in your description of reading older books, is that the problems in how to live are very parallel and very resonant with
yeah.
today, right? And you
yeah.
need that, and you need the skills to extract the meaning from especially the more forbidding older texts, right?
Yeah. Oh man, I want to take your class. I want to audit your class. I wish I may end up in Boston, and I may
can but I the be thing is, on you your can come wall? To the class, but you do have to put up your hand and participate.
Yes.
Which seems to not be a problem for you.
You're like, and that's why you're divorced. No. His name is Carlo Rotella. The book is called What Can I Get Out of This? Teaching and Learning in a Classroom Full of Skeptics. Carlo, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Carlo Rotella on Drinks with Tony. Check out his new book, What Can I Get Out of This? Teaching and Learning in a Classroom Full of Skeptics. Speaking of classrooms, I have spots available for my novel writing workshop starting this Friday at 4 p.m. online. Find the link at drinkswithtony.com to register. We meet for 8 weeks and we explore the craft, as well as learning that you already have the storytelling in your guts to write a novel. Let's harness that storytelling you have to write that novel. drinkswithtony.com has the link where you can register. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week. You're listening to Pirate Cat Radio, KPCR LP 92.9 FM Los Gatos and KMRT LP 101.9 FM Santa Cruz.
Mieux vaut ne penser à rien que ne pas penser du tout. Rien c'est déjà, rien c'est déjà beaucoup. On se souvient de rien, et puisqu'on oublie tout, rien c'est bien mieux, rien c'est bien mieux que tout. Mieux vaut ne penser à rien que de penser à vous. Ça ne me vaut rien, ça ne me vaut rien du tout. Mais comme si de rien n'était, je pense à tout. Ces petits riens qui me venaient de vous. Si c'était trois fois rien entre nous. Évidemment, ça ne fait pas beaucoup. Ce sont ces petits riens que j'ai mis bout à bout. Ces petits riens qui me venaient de vous. Mieux vaut pleurer de rien que de rire de tout. Pleurer pour un rien, c'est déjà beaucoup. Mais vous, vous n'avez rien dans le cœur, et j'avoue, je vous envie, je vous en veux beaucoup. Ce sont ces petits riens qui me venaient de vous. Le voulez-vous, tenez, que voulez-vous? Moi, je ne veux pour rien au monde, plus rien de vous. Pour être à vous, faut être à moitié fou.